Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Year in Review. As today we talk about recent papers and publications in the management of colorectal cancer. We have a great faculty today, Professor Thierry André from the Sorbonne Université Hospital Saint-Antoine in Paris, France, and Dr. Arvind Dasari from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. If you're into audio programs, check out our Oncology Today podcast series, including a recent program on metastatic colorectal cancer. As we do in all of our programs, I met with each one of the faculty separately in the last couple weeks to record a comprehensive presentation. You can see the title slides from these two presentations. They're in the chat room, and then when we send out the replay of this webinar, they will be there as well. We expect people to check out the presentations first, and then here in this webinar, we're going to try to take things to the next level in terms of clinical care and future research. Our faculty reviewed a bunch of really interesting and great papers that I discussed with them. Again, check out their presentations. But today, we're going to pick out some of the presentations, some of the concepts, and kind of see if we can sort of take it to the next level in terms of clinical care and where we might be heading. Here's where we're heading. We're just going to start out with a few introductory words about where we are in general in colorectal cancer treatment and research. We're going to emphasize to me what are two of the most important areas, I think, in the field, particularly for general medical oncologists in the community to know about: management of HER2-positive disease and also the management of MSI disease, particularly the use of immunotherapy. But we will get into a whole bunch of other areas that we know of great interest, including cell-free DNA, KRAS G12C, et cetera, and anything you want to bring up in the chat room as well. We actually did a CME program at the GI Symposium in January in San Francisco. As part of that meeting, we actually did a survey of 75 general medical oncologists, asking them to rate some of the topics in colorectal cancer. What do they want to hear more about? But also questions that they have. And we took some of the questions that they typed into that survey. We're going to bring some of them up as we go along here today. We'll talk about some in the end, but a couple as we go along, including in the introduction. So, Dr. Dasari, before we get started, you know, I mean, as always, every time we do a program of colorectal cancer, as I like to say, the three key words are always biomarkers, biomarkers, biomarkers. But of course, that is a very, very critical part right now, management. You know, to me, the strategy, you know, as we're starting to look more and more for smaller subsets, it almost in a way kind of reminds me of lung cancer, you know, smaller subsets can have more focused treatments and hopefully better outcomes. But I was mentioning that these oncologists wrote a bunch of comments and many, many questions and cases that we're going to talk about today. But I want you to take a look at this one. I was showing this to you, the faculty, before we began. One of the comments to me was kind of an expression, I guess, of, you know, frustration. We do talk about a lot of exciting biology, great clinical trials, but the truth is, particularly in the metastatic setting, this is a devastating disease. This doc says, you know, we should stop chasing these mutations. Their drugs aren't that great. The mutations are very rare. We need new good medications to treat colon cancer. Nothing new has been discovered since oxaliplatin came on the market way over 10 years ago. So, Irvin, just kind of curious, any thoughts about that? Can you maybe provide some optimism or hope to this doc and I think many others who are dealing with a very, very difficult disease?
I think this point is well taken in that these subsets tend to be small, but we are making a lot of headway in developing really effective drugs for these small subsets, taking the example of immunotherapy in MSI-high colorectal cancer, although it's just 3 to 5% of patients. For these patients, we started in the refractory setting and moved it to the front line where it's replaced chemotherapy with very very durable and sustained benefits. And the hope is that we can replicate those sort of successes in the other biomarker-driven subsets as well. And there have been biomarker-agnostic approvals, in fact, in the last year or so, including TAS-102 plus bevacizumab, as well as fruquintinib. And there's a lot of really exciting research ongoing, both in biomarker-driven subsets, such as KRAS G12C, and biomarker agnostic patient populations, such as broader KRAS mutations, as well as trying to develop immunotherapy for microsatellite stable patients. So we've come a long way, and but I think there's still a lot more work to be done. But I'm very, very optimistic that we'll make headways.
So again, Professor Andre, anything you'd like to say to address what you see as the future in this area, and particularly areas of research that you're most encouraged about?
I think your sentence is important, because oxaliplatin was a new step in adjuvant setting. It was now 20 years ago, and not a lot of progress in adjuvants, except cDNA. And cDNA is probably a revolution, because in adjuvant settings, the important point is the prognosis and to treat the good patient. We have to select the patient, and release cDNA will be a huge step probably. We need more data, but it's very important. In metastatic disease, we need NGS right now to treat the patient, to have a strategy for the patient. And it's not possible to treat a metastatic colorectal cancer without an NGS assistant.
So one more thought, Arvind, in terms of immunotherapy, of course, obviously, we've seen some great advances with MSI-high disease. Any thoughts about other extensions, particularly T-cell therapy, CAR-T, bispecifics? Any thoughts about whether this will ever enter colorectal cancer?
I think still very early days. I think as of today, in terms of approved therapies, as you know, it's still limited to checkpoint inhibitors. But there's a lot of really exciting work ongoing with other approaches, including cell-based therapies, bispecific antibodies. Early days, so should wait and see what will pan out of these efforts.
So we're going to start out talking about HER2-positive colorectal cancer. I feel like we talk about HER2-positive disease almost every day. Gastroesophageal cancer, obviously, this is a critical topic. Lung cancer, critical topic, particularly HER2-mutant disease, and of course, breast cancer, bladder cancer, biliary tract cancer. It's really amazing to see other disciplines starting to follow into the HER2 space. And Arvind, this were some of the top things that you covered, particularly the Mountaineer trial looking at tucatinib and trastuzumab, published in the Lancet Oncology, as well as the Destiny trial looking at the antibody drug conjugate trastuzumab deruxtecan. So I thought we could maybe chat a little bit about, in general, how, sort of HER2-positive disease in general, what we learned in the last 2 years about it, and what general medical oncologists need to know in general. Maybe I'll go back to you, Professor Dasari, and talk a little bit about HER2 testing in general, when you test people, how you test people, what is positive. So let's just talk a little bit about that. And do you retest people? Any thoughts, Dr. Dasari?
Yeah, and as Dr. Professor Andre rightly pointed out, we really cannot treat a metastatic colorectal cancer patient without having NGS testing done. And these panels tend to be very broad, with several hundred alterations being covered. And typically, we order it at the time of diagnosis. for most patients, that tends to be tissue-based. Can also do liquid biopsies as well. Specifically with regards to HER2 new amplification, the liquid biopsies may not be as accurate as the tissue-based testing may be. And all patients would get this NGS testing done. Now, the implications of HER2 new amplification in RAS mutated patients is unclear. There may be a role for TDXD and antibody drug conjugates, but perhaps no HER2 receptor targeted therapy. With regards to retesting, that's a really interesting question with in colorectal cancer patients. I don't think there are established guidelines, but certainly reasonable to consider if it's been a very long time since the initial testing was done and an accessible location is available, or if you're able to do a liquid biopsy.
So, Professor Andre Dilip, a doc in the chat room, Dilip Solanki, says that his pathologists do not routinely order MSI high and other markers except basic RAS testing. Docs would not think of treating breast cancer without ER/PR and HER2. How do we sort of get the message across to our pathology colleagues about the importance of biomarker testing, and what's your experience with pathologists in that regard, Professor Andre?
With my pathologist now, I ask for all my patients the immunochemistry for the four protein HMLH1, HMLH2, HMLH6, and PMS2. It's really for all colorectal cancer. It's really important, and it's important not only for diagnosis, but it's also important for the diagnosis of Lynch syndrome because it's not so rare. And I ask now immunochemistry for HER2 or amplification of HER2 by NGS, but I need HER2 also, if possible, in first line, because if it's an overexpression and the patient is RAS wild type, it's a factor of resistance to anti-GFR, and it's for this reason it's important to have HER2 at the beginning of the disease, and it's also important to have at the beginning to plan to have HER2 compound. During the strategy, if the patient is HER2.
So Dan in the chat room says he wonder, is the day going to come when there's reflex NGS testing in metastatic colorectal cancer? Interesting question. Let's talk about some of the HER2 strategies we have that we now all of a sudden we've got a couple that seem to be very effective. So again, Dr. Dasari, can you comment a little bit about what we know in the Professor Andre's talk, he goes through the paper and the data from the Mountaineer study, the new study that's going to look at upfront treatment with Mountaineer plus FOLFOX. But can you talk a little bit about what we know about the regimen in terms of efficacy, just without slides, just your own experience and what you've seen in the literature in terms of efficacy, toxicity, and also, you know, of course, in breast cancer, tucatinib was a very important issue in terms of brain mets. To what extent brain mets are an issue in colorectal cancer, and is tucatinib effective in that situation, Arvin?
Yeah, the Mountaineer trial really established the role of tucatinib plus trastuzumab in the landscape of management of metastatic colorectal cancer. This trial led to the approval of this regimen, and these were patients with previously treated HER2 new amplified colorectal cancer. And these were IHC 3+ or if 2+ confirmed on FISH or ISH. With regards to the results from the study, the response rate was around 40% or so, and the progression-free survival was around 8 to 9 months. And the patients who actually responded to this therapy, the median duration of response was around 12 to 13 months. With regards to the side effect profile, overall, it appears to be well tolerated. The regimen with perhaps the most common side effects being GI that were mostly grade 1, grade 2. My experience with this regimen has been pretty favorable. And as you just alluded to, in the patients with brain mets, there appears to be good blood-brain barrier penetration and with some intracranial activity as well. Even in patients with colorectal cancer, there are some reports that suggest that HER2-amplified patients may have a higher incidence of brain tumors. Overall, tends to be low in colorectal cancer patients, but in these patients could perhaps be used. I've personally not had a patient with HER2-amplified colorectal cancer with brain mets that I've treated with this regimen so far, but data suggests that it may be effective. The ongoing Mountaineer trial, as Professor Andre mentioned, is evaluating this approach in first-line setting where HER2-amplified colorectal cancer patients will be randomized to tucatinib plus trastuzumab versus first-line chemotherapy with FOLFOX chemotherapy backbone. The primary endpoint of the study would be progression-free survival, and this is currently ongoing.
So, Professor Andre, would you add to that, and particularly your clinical experience with the regimen? One thing that's a little bit hard to tease out sometimes is sort of the magnitude, depth, and duration of response that you see with this, and also contrast efficacy indirectly to the other HER2 strategy we're going to talk about, T-DXd.
The relationship between the test and the efficacy is clear. If we have HER2 3 cross, it's better to have HER2 cross and FISH positive. And it's also dependent on NGS of the number of copy. We have probably in HER2, like with all the test we have right now in colorectal cancer, a relationship between the test, the HER2 3 cross respond better than HER2 cross and FISH positive. I think it's important. And concerning the efficacy, it's clear that it's difficult to compare the two regimen we have right now. With trastuzumab or the Deltexan, is two possibility with two efficacy and probably the possibility to use both because it's two different therapy with possibility to have a two line for HER2.
So, Dr. Dasari, Soheil in the chat room, of course, asked about HER2 low, 1 plus. So, as defined, Ben Breast, it would be 1 or 2 plus, but FISH negative, because as we saw before, there were patients who were IHC 2 plus and ISH positive, which incidentally seemed to respond a little bit lower, which I don't know that we've seen that with breast cancer. But just kind of curious again, in terms of your take, in terms of T-DXd, in comparison, we've seen pretty significant response rate here, 45%. But of course, with T-DXd, you have the looming issue of interstitial lung disease, which was seen in this situation, but also acute GI toxicity, chemo-like toxicity. I think we've become more aware of as time is going on, at least in breast cancer. And I see other areas sort of picking up on that. Again, Arvin, any comments about T-DXd? A lot of docs have used the drug in multiple tumors, particularly breast cancer, seen very good responses. in patients who need a response, symptomatic, visceral disease, any situation where you might use it before tucatinib, trastuzumab, Arvin?
So firstly, to emphasize what both Professor Andre and you mentioned, at least in colorectal cancer, the activity of these agents seems to be limited to truly overexpressors, HER2 overexpressors. So HER2 low patients, unfortunately, do not respond to these therapies. With regards to how to really sequence these therapies, I don't think we have a clear answer. I mean, we do have trastuzumab, tucatinib trastuzumab, FDA approved, and tends to be used in second and third line. And so T-DXd is typically used in patients who've progressed on the prior therapy, both in terms of logistics because of drug availability, as well as the known toxicities that you mentioned, not the least being pneumonitis. Which situation would I use T-DXd or consider using T-DXd first? Perhaps the occasional patient who has a RAS mutation but is HER2 new amplified, I think that would be a potential situation where I would think about using T-DXd because this is an antibody drug conjugate. It's just using the HER2 receptor to deliver the payload.
Yeah, that's a great point. Professor Andre, of course, a huge issue with T-DXd is concerned about interstitial lung disease. Of course, the breast cancer people have a much longer history dealing with that, and they're using it earlier and earlier, being very aggressive about screening, trying to pick up ILD before it becomes symptomatic. Is that kind of general strategy kind of going to be brought into colorectal cancer? And would you like to be able to use T-DXd right now? Let's say you have a patient who's already had tucatinib, trastuzumab, and is still in good condition, wants to be treated. You don't have, approved alternatives. Would you like to be able to use T-DXd right now? Or do you think we need more data?
I think we have really post therapy. We don't know what is the best. We don't know what we will begin with. But the lung toxicity now is known. We have to deal with. We have to have CT to look and really to stop therapy if we have a grade 1 or grade 2. Some problem at the beginning. It's some problem with the higher dose. But I think now it's possible to deal with this toxicity and really grade 5 is rare. It was one in this publication with a dose at 6.4 milligram per kilo. But really, if with follow up with CT every 2 months, I think we can deal with this toxicity.
So any final comments about T-DXd, Arvin, in terms of, again, the acute GI toxicity? We think of antibody drug conjugates as, very focused chemotherapy drug delivery. But as time went on, I think the breast people realized that patients were having fairly significant acute emetogenic issues. What's your experience been acutely with that? Do you pre-medicate people intensively, Arvin, who are going to get T-DXd?
Yeah, I have had patients have significant diarrhea. That's been, the big issue, and to a lesser extent, nausea. I think where the main thing would be to really watch out for the side effects, counsel the patients, and address these side effects early on, not just the pneumonitis, but also the GI toxicities as well. Don't really pre-medicate, at least in my practice, either for the pneumonitis or the GI toxicities, but be very aggressive early on.
All right, let's move on and talk about MSI-high disease and, of course, the use of checkpoint inhibitors. Here are some of the papers that we reviewed in the session. looking at not only metastatic disease, but neoadjuvant therapy, immunotherapy, which of course got a lot of play with the initial paper out of Memorial with neoadjuvant dostarlimab and MSI-high rectal cancer. And now as it's spread beyond that, a lot of interest in that and continuing interest in the management of metastatic disease. And Professor Andre, we already have several people in the chat room asking about MSI testing. So can you kind of go back through what you see when you get IHC, what you see with, you know, when you see NGS, and basically what you do in terms of diagnostic testing when you do it, looking for MSI high, Professor Andre?
Yeah, in Europe, we begin, and I say it's the same in the U.S., we begin by immunochemistry. It's four proteins. We have the loss of HMSLH1 and PMS2 and HMSH6 and HMSH2. If it's the case, and if it's not heterogeneous, the probability to have an MSI patient is probably 99%. But if the immunochemistry is negative, it's possible to miss some MSI. And it's the reason it's better to have both, to have immunochemistry and to have PCR or NGS, because the two techniques, it's better to have two compared to one. And also with immunochemistry, careful if it's a loss of only one protein, because some misdiagnosed and in previous study in the 8HW, probably in the Keynote 177, the rate of misdiagnosed is probably around 10%. And for this reason, careful with the diagnosis. Better to have two techniques, and interpretation of immunochemistry is important, because if it's a loss of the two copper protein, it's good. If you have only one, or if you have a heterogeneous aspect, careful and please wait NGS or PCR.
So, Dr. Dasari, can you kind of maybe put in your thoughts about, you know, the idea of missing somebody who has such a treatable lesion? I was just flashing on early on in lung cancer when people thought that smokers didn't get mutations, which of course they do. And I thought about all those people who could have been treated during those years before we figured that out. What's your strategy to try to avoid missing somebody with MSI high, Dr. Dasari, and any misconceptions or myths or mistakes you see people making about MSI testing?
I think MSI testing is probably the one test that is absolutely required in every colorectal cancer patient we see, irrespective of stage. It should be ordered in everybody. Has not just prognostic and predictive implications, but also screening implications as well. So every patient should be tested for it. And as Professor Andre mentioned, we'd start with IHC if suspicious, also do a PCR, and NGS testing could also provide information as well. Not every panel may be able to report out MSI, but you can at least get clues from the tumor mutation burden.
And Professor Andre Thoy in the chat room wants to know, what about liquid biopsy to pick up MSI?
I think it's not the best way to have MSI, because not all MSI at the cDNA, and for this reason, can be helpful, but if you have a negative test, you don't avoid MSI. It's only a help. It's probably interesting for metastatic disease. But at this time, it's not the better way for the diagnosis of MSI, because immunochemistry is very cheap, very simple, very efficient, and we have also a PCR and NGS on the tumor, and really it's a better way.
So let's talk a little bit about these two questions I put up there. Pretty broad questions, but certainly we're hearing a lot about it. I'll start with you, Dr. Dosari. I mentioned the original rectal study, and now we're seeing so many neoadjuvant trials. Can you kind of like put that in perspective right now? And, you know, right now, what are some of the trials, the research concepts looking at this concept? And what are situations right now where you think about or actually using neoadjuvant IOs in MSI high disease?
So, based on the trial out of MSK and other supporting data, including some data from our institution here at MD Anderson, the NCCN guidelines do include immunotherapy as a potential option for MSI-high rectal cancers in the neoadjuvant setting. In lieu of the standard chemoradiation and chemotherapy. In fact, there are some data that suggest that MSI-high rectal cancers may not respond that well to neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Now, moving to the colon, no doubt that there is activity with immunotherapy in these patients with colon cancer as well. The question more is, are we able to do a watch and wait approach in these patients with colon cancer as compared to those in the rectum where surgery may be associated with greater morbidity? The question there is still being debated hotly as to whether you should consider immunotherapy in MSI-high colon cancers in spite of the activity that we see. With regards to adjuvant use of immunotherapy, there are ongoing trials, including a large cooperative group trial here in the U.S., the ATOMIC trial that's finished enrollment, and we're awaiting the results of that trial to know whether adjuvant immunotherapy would add on more to the standard of care chemotherapy.
So, Professor Andre, you also talked in your talk about some really interesting work with anti-LAG-3. So, relatimab, which we know from melanoma, plus nivolumab in the neoadjuvant setting, a very impressive hazard rate. Any thoughts about not only where neoadjuvant immunotherapy is heading, Professor Andre, but also this strategy of IO or nivolumab plus relatimab?
I think it's difficult to have an answer to this question because nivolumab works well. Anti-PD-L1 alone, we have the niche 1, the niche 3, combi of nivo and ipilimumab, but we have also other trials in China with anti-PD-L1 alone. And it's difficult to tell if anti-LAG-3 adds something at this time. We have little trial with good results, but the just to add one point at the what Arvin explained for neoadjuvant for rectal, really it's a revolution to use immuno because the therapy of rectal cancer it's complex and difficult for the patient with the chemo, the radiotherapy, the surgery. For colon cancer is more complex because for colon cancer it's not possible to have the stage by the CT, and really stage 2 are cured by surgery. And for this reason, it's really complex. I am convinced by the paper of the MD Anderson by the fact if it's a locally advanced disease, if the surgeon tells, I need a therapy before the surgery because it's a huge tumor, it's probably maybe peritoneal carcinomatosis. It's clear that it's necessary to give immunotherapy before, but for patient stage 2 or stage 3, we need clinical trial. We need to probably have some randomization between surgery alone, especially for stage 2. It's complex. The methodology to demonstrate the things is complex, and we for adjuvant we are waiting the US trial. But if the US trial is positive, it's that immuno add something, but the problem if we had to continue chemo or not, and the question is probably to avoid chemo and to give adjuvant therapy with a chemo for MSI patients.
So, Dr. Sari, let's go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to really reiterate a great point that Professor Andre brought up, and that CTs are not really very accurate in staging colon cancers, and we've seen that in the Foxtrot and Neocall studies as well. So, great point.
Yeah. And especially so, MSI, because MSI had a lot of nodes. It's sometimes important tumor, and it's really a discrepancy between the CT and the surgical the pathologic report in this situation.
So another question that I put up there before, and I'm really is one of the main questions. I'm really curious to hear what your thoughts are about. Is optimal first-line therapy of MSI-high metastatic disease in a variety of situations, including younger patients who are generally in good condition who want to do whatever they can, and more typical older patients who maybe want to try to avoid toxicity. And Arvin, maybe you can kind of summarize sort of where we were before the ASCO GI meeting, and then we'll ask Professor Andre to talk a little bit about this CheckMate 8. HW and how that added to the discussion. So where were we and where were you before ASCO GI, Dr. Dasari, in terms of this question of first-line therapy and any thoughts about these data that were presented there?
The MSI high setting is a great paradigm for drug development in colon cancer, where we started with these immunotherapies in the refractory setting, saw great activity, moved it quickly through earlier lines, and where immunotherapy replaced chemotherapy as the first line treatment option for these patients. And this is based on the KEYNOTE-177 trial that randomized patients with MSI-high colorectal cancer in the first-line setting to pembrolizumab versus chemotherapy, and clearly showed benefit for pembrolizumab in progression-free survival, response rate, as well as a better tolerability. And since then was really the standard of care for these patients. And there was always this debate of, well, would a dual checkpoint inhibitor be better than a single checkpoint inhibitor? That's a question that, we have hints that perhaps maybe it'd be better, but never a true head-to-head comparison. And that's where the field stood coming into GI ASCO.
So, Professor Andre, can you talk a little bit about the CheckMate 8? HW study and how that how people reacted to it, questions you've got about it, your thoughts about it.
It's an amazing trial with amazing results, because the hazard ratio is 0.21. It's really rare in medical oncology. The all subgroups benefit of the therapy, and one important is the group of liver metastasis, and really it's rare to have this kind of curve in metastatic disease, in GI metastatic disease, and really this therapy incredible progress for management of patients. The toxicity is there, but it's difficult to compare with the pembro alone, because to have a cross comparison, it's not fair, because it's not the same way. It's not the same investigator. And sometimes my feeling is monotherapy is probably sufficient for some patients, but combi works well. And in the future, we have to define what patient for the mono what patients for the combi, or for the reason of toxicity, for the reason of also of price, because it's not the same price. But clearly at this time, combi works, seems at better results compared to monotherapy. And really, we are waiting the second part of the HW, the comparison between Nivo and Nivo EP. It's a very important, very important second part to define what patient for mono and what patient for combi.
So, Dr. Dosari, if you look at that curve there in the upper left, I'll tell you that our group was doing a meeting and we had Matt Smith from MGH and prostate cancer, and he put up a curve that looked like that. It was actually with hormone therapy, and he called it a pelican graph. That's a hazard rate of 0.21. That's what we want to see, is that open up there a little bit. The pelican open its mouth a little bit. But in spite of all the enthusiasm, Dr. Dosari, what does this mean today? Again, you think about renal, for example, where the combination ipi-nivo is often utilized and often long-term results. What do you think about this new data? Until we can see a comparison of single agent nivo, if you have a younger patient who you think could tolerate this, wants to do the best they can. If you could, would you like to use this strategy, Arvin?
Yeah, well, first off, congratulations to Professor Andre and his team for these spectacular results, a huge development for the field. While awaiting the results of all the ongoing trials, when would we think about using the dual checkpoint inhibitor right off the bat? As we've seen in Keynote 177, even though all the patients were MSI high, about 40%, 30 to 40% of the patients had intrinsic resistance to immunotherapy, to pembrolizumab. And when you look at the curves in the initial part of the trial, chemotherapy actually did better. So clearly not everybody responds to checkpoint inhibitor pembrolizumab in this case. So if there are patients who are healthy and really need a radiographic response, perhaps those would be patients in whom I'd consider starting with a dual checkpoint inhibitor.
What about chemo plus IO? I know, we try to stay, pure or whatever, but particularly for the early bump that you get from chemo, Arvin, we're going out to SGO next week. They're fighting over which chemo to give with IO, but that's their first-line therapy, chemo plus IO. Are there situations, do we know much about that in colorectal cancer, the combination?
There are ongoing trials evaluating this. We're hoping to get results soon. But I think the same rationale would apply here as did previously with regards to patients in whom we really need a radiographic response with patients who have really bulky disease. I think those would be the patients where I would consider using chemotherapy plus IO. And certainly we have established safety data with these combinations, so could consider in those situations.
So I don't know, there's Arvinder in the chat room who wants to know about a patient with MSI high and BRAF mutant and BRCA2. And actually, this was a case here we got from one of the docs in the survey, 57-year-old man, HNPCC and BRAF. What comes first, IO or chemo? So in both situations, Professor Andre, MSI high and BRAF, what comes first, IO or BRAF?
I think it's no question about this question. It's only one question. It's really immuno-oncology because results of nivo-epi or pembro in patient MSI BRAF with the V600 mutation is pretty good, and it is the proportion of long control of the disease is important, and it's not a prognostic factor in MSI treated by immuno-oncology BRAF V600E. We have some results with chemo and with anti-BRAF compound plus anti-GFR, but it's not on the same range. It's less impressive. And really, for this question, I don't know what is the advice of Arvin, but for me, it's really no question about the fact we have to begin with immuno-oncology.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that I would add is there is an ongoing trial, the CMARC trial, that is looking at combining immunotherapy to BRAF-targeted therapy in these patients who are MSI-high and BRAF-mutated. That trial is currently enrolling. But in clinical practice, absolutely start with immunotherapy.
All right. Well, let's buzz through a bunch of other issues that we talked about in these two great presentations. Again, we're not going to show many slides. I just want to chat here a little bit. We know there are people out there shoveling the snow. Listen to us. So here we go. Let's start out with cell-free DNA, one of the favorite topics in oncology nowadays, bespoke assays, TMB, and MRD, and particularly the Signatera bespoke type assay. Arvin, can you kind of comment on where you see us today, right now? I was kind of surprised that the NCCN kind of doesn't really bless this yet. Yet it looks like everybody's doing it. You can order the assay. I don't know, maybe they don't have as much they need more evidence than the average doc, but I see a lot of investigators doing it. What's your current approach to this, Arvin? I know there's some great trials going on, but based on the research we have right now, where do you think, if at all, is it applicable to use this kind of strategy in the adjuvant colon setting?
So what we know as of today is that the detection of ctDNA-defined minimal residual disease after surgery portends a much higher risk of recurrence as compared to those who are ctDNA negative. What we also know is that patients who are ctDNA positive, if they get adjuvant chemotherapy, some of them would clear their ctDNA, and that clearance would be transient in some, more sustained in others, and that determines the prognosis. So a lot of data also kind of show similar outcomes in patients who finished adjuvant therapy and undergoing surveillance, those who are ctDNA positive, high risk of recurrence versus those who don't. Now, so clearly a very, very prognostic biomarker, kind of black and white in terms of how it performs, and truly revolutionary, as Professor Andre mentioned. Now, the missing piece is the clinical utility piece. I mean, how do we use these data to determine what to do for our patients and tell them kind of beyond, look, you're at a higher risk of the cancer coming back or a lesser risk of the cancer coming back. But beyond that, what can we tell them to change the treatment paradigms? That's the missing piece. Currently, where we have the best data for that would be in stage 2 colon cancer patients who are at relatively lower risk of recurrence to begin with. And if their ctDNA assays come back negative after surgery, these could be potential patients where you would think about de-escalating adjuvant therapy. So that's where we are. And in other situations, I think we're still waiting for data to accumulate. And as you rightly pointed out, the NCCN has taken somewhat of a conservative stance while waiting on all these data to accumulate to establish clinical utility. And in fact, as Professor Andre mentioned, outside of the United States, I think there are not a whole lot of settings where you're even able to order this as part of routine clinical care.
So, Professor Andre, you know, the NCCN makes recommendations, you know, based on evidence. Our group, we just ask the investigators what they do in their practice, and if they all do the same thing, well, then we call that a consensus. So they do different things. I'm just sort of joking, but really that is our practical approach. And the thing that's so interesting in this situation is most investigators say they, and contrary to what the NCCN is saying, that they do use it. Dr. Dasari, before I get to Professor Andre, do you use the assay outside of trial yourself?
Very rarely. We had the chance to have a trial in France for stage two, and we try to include patients in clinical trial. If we have some particular case, it's possible we use. If, for example, it's not possible to include in a clinical trial, but it's really particular. It's only because I work in a university center, but in practice, CDNA is only in clinical in clinical study in Europe, not in clinical practice.
So, Arvind, any thoughts about what the lag time is between picking it up in ctDNA and, you know, sort of routine imaging? Obviously, the longer it is, theoretically, maybe the more advantage. Do we know roughly what kind of lag time there is? And in a second, I'm going to ask you for a second opinion or a third opinion, a second opinion that we had sent in to us. But any thoughts, though, about, again, this assay, Arvind?
So the current lead time, according to published data, varies anywhere from 5 to 9 months. And some of the older data, it's about 9 months. When we looked at our data, to answer your earlier question, we do order it on everybody, more kind of to generate data and establish benchmarks. And in our practice, what we noted was that patients who were ctDNA positive during surveillance, about 50% of them actually had radiographic evidence of disease already. And so keeping that in mind, if the lead time in our data set was lower, 3 months including everybody, and 5 months who were truly MRD positive, taking out the subset who were who had positive scans. So that's been our practice. And hopefully with future assays, and there are a lot of assays being developed, we'll have greater sensitivity, longer lead times that will help us intervene in a meaningful fashion.
So two quick cases or questions. One from the chat room for Professor Andre. This is from Anissa. If the ctDNA is a positive with stage 2 colon cancer, but there are no other high-risk features outside of a clinical trial, you know, if it were your patient, would you treat?
Yes, because I know if the ctDNA is positive, the risk of relapse is very important. And yes, but in clinical practice, we don't have this test in my country.
All right, one more. Well, this is a little more complicated, Dr. Dasari. Here it is. Recently, I saw a patient for a second opinion where she has stage 2A colon cancer being monitored ctDNA, which was negative for almost 9 months. Suddenly, her ctDNA was positive, and a month later, her CT scan showed metastatic disease. CEA has always been normal, even with metastatic disease. Now she's getting treated for stage 4 colon cancer. Would you use ctDNA to monitor in the metastatic setting in this patient, Dr. Dasari? And also, it brings up the general issue of the use of these assays in the metastatic setting. For example, status posts a local treatment for oligometastatic disease. Any thoughts about this case and about this situation?
Yeah, very unfortunate that this patient with what appears to be low-risk stage 2 colon cancer and also ctDNA negative unfortunately developed a recurrence. As I just mentioned, even in our cohort, not everybody had a lead time of many months. About 50% of the patients, actually, their ctDNA turned positive right about when their scans were positive as well. Perhaps this kind of highlights the need for more sensitive assays to be developed for MRD tracking. Now, with regards to the use of ctDNA in the metastatic setting, I think the question would be, what are we using that ctDNA testing for? Is it for tumor profiling? In that case, yes, I think it's very reasonable to use. But if we're asking the question of, can we use ctDNA to see whether the patient is responding to chemotherapy or not, I think that's more controversial. We really don't have any good cutoffs to define what a response is. So I'm more very hesitant to recommend using that, using ctDNA to determine response to conventional chemotherapy. Having said that, there is CMS coverage for using Signatera for immunotherapy response, although probably not used as widely as it is used for MRD testing. A really, really intriguing area where ctDNA is being used in the metastatic setting is in patients who are being treated with EGFR antibodies and trying to evaluate for the presence of resistance mechanisms before re-challenging them with these EGFR antibodies after a period of treatment holiday from these drugs.
So, Professor Andre, quick question from the chat room. Asymptomatic patient, MSI high, metastatic disease, slow asymptomatic disease progression on pembrolizumab. Have you or would you switch to ipi/nivo in a patient like that?
I try to do, but I have no results of that. We have study, but not results at this time. We have some results in other disease, like in melanoma and in kidney, without not fantastic results. And it's not so clear that nivo epi can be useful in the situation of resistance, probably for some patients. But at this time, we don't have the answers at this question.
Arvin, is that a strategy that you have ever utilized? And it also kind of gets into the ideas about mechanisms of resistance to IOs and MSI high disease. I hear lots of cases of people who don't respond. So any thoughts in terms of, again, mechanism resistance and any other issues related to this?
Yeah, I completely agree. I don't think we have robust enough data to say that a dual checkpoint inhibition would be effective after a single checkpoint inhibitor fails. I have that discussion with the patient, and as long as the patient is aware, I do try dual checkpoint inhibition, but after a thorough discussion with the patient.
But just one point. So the first cause of resistance is misdiagnosed. It's very important to remember that, because it's not so rare. And the first thing is to be sure that it's an MSI, and also to take in consideration the fact it's some pseudo progression also at the beginning of the therapy is very important for MSI.
That's a really great point. So, Professor Andre and Dr. Dasari, thank you so much for working with us today. We all learned so much. Audience, thank you for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night.